This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, your station for fresh news, smart talk all day. You are on the clock with Erin Green on this Thursday, the 21st of October, 2021. On the clock, we engage organizations, institutions, social and cultural leaders, and ordinary people to better understand the impact of public policy, private sector development, and emerging social and consumer trends. On the clock, we have conversations that help us understand and navigate a rapidly changing Bahamas. Good morning. Today, I have a guest joining me to talk about the pandemic and some aspects of life in the pandemic that we haven't really paid attention to. But before we get to that portion of the show, we got some what's in the news to talk about. Well, the first thing I want to announce is the 16th annual Anatole Rogers Memorial Lecture that will be held on Thursday, the 11th of November, 2021 at 7 p.m. This year's lecture will be given by Edwidge Dandekat, the renowned Haitian literary genius and writer, Haitian-American novelist, short story writer, essayist, and what they call memoirist. She writes memoirs. And the title of this year's lecture is To Dream a Better World, Storytelling in Times of Distress. Wow. Edwidge Dandekat. A lecture not to be missed. In fact, every single lecture since its inception has been phenomenal. And I'm sure this is just going to be another one to add to the list. And I got a full day today. Last night while I was sitting preparing my show, I wanted to tell y'all, since we are, all engrossed in all of these fascinating mysteries, like the mysterious case of the mutilated money and the ordinary case of the unordered vaccines. Well, I had planned on telling y'all the story of why monkey tamarin does itch. But I don't think I have enough time for that today, because yesterday we had our very, very first press briefing. And I want to go into it just briefly, because there are a lot of important things that came out of it. More important, I think, than the briefing itself. But there are things that must be noted. First of all, did we need the Director of Communications to introduce the new press secretary at the beginning of the first press briefing? Is that necessary? And see, coupled with the question, see, when you couple that question with this question, is the press secretary a government employee, or is he a Davis administration employee? This is a very important distinction to make, right? I think it's a bit too much and unnecessary. We know who the press secretary is, but you're not an elected official. And I'm going to be honest, in this capacity, anyway. We also know what a press secretary is and what a press secretary does. See, to me, it was concerning to me because governments are continuous. It's administrations that change. And so the question, is this press secretary a press secretary for the government or for the administration, is very important. And see, when we double back to another question, right, is it really a new day? I'm not sure if the Davis administration understand the extent to which their own party campaign was compromised within the first few weeks of its appointment as the new government. For surely, nobody thought when you said it was a new day that we would see the return of individuals like Jerome Fitzgerald. I want to see communications from my government, a continuous government, and not necessarily from a particular party's administration. Because it felt like the press secretary was really doing a very good job of trying to sell the government's agenda. And I'm not quite sure that's what a press secretary's job is. But there were some very interesting and important issues that were covered in that press briefing. I think it was a relatively decent press briefing, besides the sort of air of mimicry of global North practices and things like that. Five priority issues indicated in the briefing is COVID and the healthcare system, stabilizing the economy, climate change, the legislative agenda, which would include the VAT reduction bill, essentially a pension increase bill, and a merchant bill, and then the announcement that the board selections will be finalized and announced by next week. There's also a briefing from the new Minister of Housing and Transportation, Jo Beth Colby, on the Prospect Ridge Housing Program. That's a very interesting discussion. Can't really get into it right now, but what I thought was very interesting was the focus and prioritization of projects in Abaco. This conversation about Prospect Ridge Housing Program is very interesting, but what I enjoyed most from that segment of the briefing was Ms. Colby's ability to say calmly to the audience, I don't understand your question. I don't think you all understand how beautiful it was to hear a government minister say, I don't understand the question. I'm certain I'm not answering it properly. I don't understand the question. I want to say thank you for setting the tone, Ms. Colby. And it's okay to say, I don't know. I don't understand the question. I'll get back to you when I've established further clarity, right? Awesome stuff. There's still a lot to get into. But the most fascinating part about the press briefing was this sort of odd statement from the press secretary about the BPL report. Listen, if you've been listening to me on the radio, I wouldn't even say follow, right? If you've been listening to me on the radio for the last few years, you will know that it sounds like I'm so jealous of BPL, I won't wait there, but it's not that. I have just been following BPL and BEC and the development of the management at those institutions, because they sort of two separate, entities, because I grew up in the blackout era. I grew up in a time where you had to plan your life around the fact that you don't know when the power is going off, but it most certainly is going to go off. So these things are very important to me. And I'm just going to read the quote. I got to find it again. It's just so fascinating. A quote from the press secretary. This is what he said at that briefing. And I'm reading from the Tribune. Clint Watson, the press secretary in the office of the prime minister, teased details about the report during a press conference yesterday. Quote, the former prime minister in office commissioned an investigation into Bahamas Power and Light. The board, the initial board that was led by then Chairman Darnell Osborne, he said. Quote, we've not heard from that report. We can confirm today that a report was done by a foreign company. Let me repeat, quote, we've not heard from that report. We can confirm today that a report was done by a foreign company. The name of that company we're going to release to you as well, and I think you may be happy, you might be happy to know that we do have this report in hand. It is a very interesting read, and of course, it's now being sent to the minister responsible for BPL, the Minister of Works, Alfred Sayers, for his review on it. It's interesting. You want to read this, and it may share a very clear picture as to why we never heard about this report, which was presented in November of last year to the government. It explains a lot. I'll say it and leave it as that. Okay, listen. I don't have enough time today to delve into this. We don't have enough time. I mean, there's not enough Frank Watson Boulevard in the world to have time to deal with this. However, some interesting things. So the government commissioned, the Prime Minister commissioned an investigation, but we've not heard from that report. Who is we? Is we the brave Davis administration, or is we the government, the Ministry of Works, the cabinet, secretary to the cabinet, right? That's a distinction, I think, that needs to be determined, right? Because Clint Watson says, and I think you might be happy to know that we do have this report in hand. Shouldn't the government have the report in hand? Like, which foreign company could initiate this, like, could on their own without an invitation from BPL or a member of the Bahamian government? How does a foreign company just up and decide to do a report on BPL? And why would I be happy to know it's in the government's hand? I mean, I would be happy to know that it has not gone the way of other files and reports and investigations that can't seem to be found by the government's hands. But this isn't clear enough to me to make sense of it. Anyway, this is fascinating, and we're going to get into it. I have a guest today, and I got to do a little more research. We better be get very careful when we're engaging in these types of conversations. You see, because here's the next thing. When you read this story and you realize that the now Minister of Works, Alfred Sayers, was the lawyer for this group of people suing the government, why would we appoint Sayers to Minister of Works, understanding the enormity of this situation, considering the importance of the country's ability to generate and distribute electricity? Like, this is the thing. I'm not making any suggestions that the Honorable Minister Sayers has done or will do anything untoward. But if you have the ability to avoid conflicts of interest, why wouldn't you just do that? You got a 32-member House. We don't rely on ministers for technical expertise. And maybe we could have used the Senate to appoint somebody with the expertise, holistic, right? Multidimensional expertise to fill this position, as opposed to using the Senate to placate and to provide party favors. We got to just spend a little more time interrogating the work in front of us critically. You're not nitpicking. You're looking for anything that could be exploited. Oh, my. Anyway, I've got a couple of texts here before I move into the second segment of the show. First text says, political parties need more than a single leadership race, but all offices should be in the election, not just for the overall leader. The system is sad, not because MPs won their seats in a meager opposition team. Those few have the caliber of headship for the party to be PM. Our country should shy away from sly candidates as well. Popularity is a danger too. Yes, I think this text is referring to another story in the paper about the FNM leadership race. I too wonder why leader of the party is the only position going to vote when you have the deputy leader and the chairman of the party that I think from the way that the party members themselves speak hold significant weight and onus in the leadership discussion. One more quick text before we go to a break and I bring in my next guest. I concur, press conference and specifically press secretary gave the impression of still being on the election campaign trail. That's exactly the feeling that I got when I was listening to it, right? You see, because governments are continuous. When do you make that transition, right? From the politics to the governance. And how do you make that transition? How do you couch your administration's ideas and decisions against the past administration without politicking? It can be done. It can be done. That's another quick text. Good day. There will be a full FNM convention in February. So I've been told. I know. I hear that. And that's cool too. But if this particular convention is about leadership, right? Then aren't the chairman and the deputy leader sort of equally complicit or liable or like responsible for leadership and pushing the party forward? Plus, given the nature of the circumstances surrounding Peter Turnquest's resignation, I mean, whether it was offered or asked for or demanded, I thought that would warrant that position's inclusion in this particular discussion. But we're not talking about that today. Arlington, let's go to a break. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to bring in my guest from the Ministry of Social Services and Urban Development. Stay tuned to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. We will be right back on the clock with Erin Green.
Have you heard about the COVID vaccine raffle? If you are vaccinated against COVID-19, you can enter to win amazing prizes like food store gift certificates, hotel stays, beach excursions, and so much more. Even if you are previously vaccinated, you can still enter to win. The COVID vaccine is free, safe, and protects you from severe COVID-19 infections. Don't delay. Get vaccinated today and enter to win. Visit www.vaxbahamas.com to register.
What happened to you? You look like you lost your paycheck.
Man, I just realized I got scammed out of a bunch of money. They said I won this contest and just needed me to send them some money so I could collect. I mean, to expedite something. Or was it to smooth the process?
Man, you're smarter than that. Protect yourself against scams and fraud by following these tips. If you know you didn't enter a competition, you can't win. Never pay to receive a cash prize. If you're being asked, you're being scammed. Check trusted internet sites for verification of information given to you. Do not give your banking details to people you don't know. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. Monitor your bank account regularly for any questionable transactions. Get more information at GetMoneySmartBahamas.com.
Make it count this time. Census 2021 for your family line. You better get ready. It's about that time. So tell mama to be ready. Tell it to the whole family. The rock that's up for two. The count depends on you. So tell Ted to go tell below. Lock it down on your calendar. Census 2021. This one's for everyone.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Good morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, your station for fresh news, smart talk, all day. You're on the clock with Erin Green. And just as I move into my next segment, I got to just say this quickly. In the business section of The Guardian, the headline, Air Canada to add weekly direct flights to Exuma and resume daily flights to LPIA. Let me just say this. I hope that the Minister of Finance and the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Transportation has put together a, I don't know if it's a emergency strategic plan or contingency plan, first of all, to ensure that the proper resources and human resources are in place in Exuma to mitigate or diminish or minimize the risk of spread and outbreak in Exuma, right? And that you put in place an emergency travel protocol for sick individuals, particularly those that do not have their own personal insurance. This is very, very important. I think this is one of the biggest things that we have overlooked is the devastation of COVID in family islands with weaker healthcare systems, if that could be a thing. Arlington, I see we got this caller. You got 30 seconds. I got a guest I'm about to bring in. Good morning. Still there? You're not there? Okay, I'm sorry, caller, we lost you. Let me introduce my guest for this morning. My guest is Ms. Tonette Minnis. She is a trained social worker currently working in the Domestic Violence and Counseling Unit at the Department of Social Services. She is also an adjunct professor at the University of the Bahamas. She obtained her bachelor's degree in sociology with a concentration in social services from California State University of East Bay. She then went on to obtain a master's degree in social work with a concentration on children, youth, and families from California State University of East Bay. She has nearly 20 years in the field of social work, working with vulnerable populations both locally and abroad. Good morning, Ms. Minnis. Good morning. Are you there? Oh, unmute your mic, ma'am. Ah, boy. Arlington, let's go to this caller while we try to get that sorted out. Good morning, caller. You're on the clock.
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Morning. May I speak with Empress, please?
You have called the wrong... I mean, like, I am an empress, Rastafari, but you called the wrong station. Sister family, but wrong station. Ah, boy. Sorry about that, ma'am. I wish you had been following. We could have had a conversation. Another text says, morning, when will we get things right? Corruption is the rule of the day, but we need to see the shift away into transparency. We need to stop us and them story. So you're saying that we need to change the way that we engage and talk about corruption? We need to change this us versus them? I agree with you. A big part of it is of our inability to deal with corruption is the way that we approach it and the perspective that we approach it from. Got another caller on the line? No? Okay. Ms. Minnis, are you there? All right, here we go. Well, I'm going to give Ms. Minnis a few moments to get back with us. Let's talk about the presentation on the Prospect Ridge Housing Program and other initiatives being taken on, or initiatives, housing initiatives that were put in place by the previous government and that the new government is considering. So what I learned in that press conference is that Abaco has been prioritized. Abaco has been prioritized as a workplace. The first initiative, there is a 21-lot subdivision in Spring City that they are currently working on. Other lot sites are Central Pines and Sands Cove, even though they didn't indicate how many actual lots would be available in those two other sites. I just want to say, if Ms. Minnis is listening, perhaps you could try the toll-free number that I sent you. That's an easier way to communicate. And then maybe go focus on Prospect Ridge. This was a very interesting discussion. What Ms. Colby, the Honorable Minister Colby, indicated was that the Prospect Ridge development project had not progressed sufficiently to be able to determine viability, even costs and timelines, that the government couldn't commit to the previous administration's costs because, as Ms. Colby said, no data or actual master plan exists. And the selection process has been temporarily halted till viability and costs have been determined. Now, we see in the paper today that the Senator Gardner has indicated that that is not necessarily the truth. I really would love to see further investigation, or at least to continue the conversation so we can clarify what exactly has happened. You see, because as far as I'm concerned, when the Senator Gardner says in the paper that this project is to essentially assist a category of people who were barred from ownership or faced great barriers from ownership, I'm trying to think what's happening here, because this is a high-end housing development. This isn't a low-end. This isn't a, it's not like the low-cost housing program, or it shouldn't be, right? I don't understand how this category of people have been marginalized from home ownership. Just 1 second, Arlington. My guest is saying that the Zoom platform won't allow her to unmute herself. I got it. All right. So it goes on. Ms. Colby went on to talk about the Carmichael subdivision project, and that is moving along. They are currently working on completing the roads. She also indicated that there are other parcels of land available for assessment for housing initiatives by the state. An important question that was asked was, has an overall budget been determined for the entire housing initiative, government's housing initiative, and that hasn't been determined yet. And I thought that was a very impressive showing for the first press briefing of a new minister. I thought that she handled questions soundly. And again, you know, I want to reiterate that there's nothing I appreciate more than a minister that could get up and say, look here, I can be honest with you, I don't think I understand your question. Could you reiterate it? And a minister that says, hey, when I speak, I want to speak with clarity, and I don't want to make statements when I know that I don't have all of the information necessary for that statement. There was also a briefing on the climate change situation. And the most interesting question, I think, was, is the Davis administration going to revisit current oil drilling agreements? And let me just say this. I think that we need a specific press briefing on this issue. I know that it wasn't the government's attempt to avoid this issue. That's not what happened at all. This question was raised by a member of the press. It's an important question. And I think it requires an entire press briefing with the inclusion of several other ministries and technical experts in the discussion. But I think the question was asked, is Davis's position as leader of the opposition changed now that he is the PM? And the response was essentially, he is still consulting with local experts. I see Arlington, my guest is online. Good morning, Ms. Minnis. How are you? Good morning, Ms. Minnis. How you do? You still there? Ah, somebody has their radio on. I think I just heard my voice muffled. Oh boy, Ms. Minnis, I am so sorry. Keep trying, Arlington. Let's get to that caller on the line. Good morning, caller. You're on the clock.
Good morning, Ms. Green. I listen to you every morning.
Yes.
But in particular, after that press briefing and the fact that the Minister of Health, in my opinion, did a splendid job the way she dealt with the press on housing matters.
Mm-hmm.
But what I am intrigued by the fact that you mentioned this morning with respect to oil drilling in the Bahamas, you definitely need a...
I lost you there. Go on. Okay. Oh, good morning, Ms. Minnis. That's you on the line. How are you?
I'm good, and you?
I am good, thank you. I am so happy. I'm so happy to have you here. Sorry for the technical difficulties. We can blame them on my Chikchanis. I did not pay them this month. Sometimes they get disgruntled. How are you?
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here to talk about this issue we're going to sort of dig into today.
Absolutely. And again, Ms. Minnis is a trained social worker currently working in the Domestic Violence and Counseling Unit at the Department of Social Services. Well, Ms. Minnis, let's start with please tell me what it is that you do and what you've come to talk to us about today.
Well, I'll start with what I want to talk about and the issue of domestic violence, in that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month internationally. And so we've been doing seminars. We've had a seminar and we've been making appearances with different NGOs to sort of talk about this issue and raise awareness throughout the public. And so what I do is survivors of domestic violence will get referred to us from various different entities via the courts, the police, NGOs, and we sort of help them to navigate their situation, whether it's going to the court to file for a protection order or finding them any temporary housing or working with them with relatives to relocate to different places, or sometimes they've gotten out of the situation, but they just need counseling. They need someone to help them to heal from the trauma of domestic violence. And so that's what we're there to do.
Absolutely. Well, let's start at the very beginning. How can people contact this unit?
You can call us at 604-4300. You can also call the national hotline, who can then get in contact with us. And our national hotline number is 322-2763 or 422-2763.
Right, and that's a 24-hour hotline, right?
24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Awesome. That's awesome. Let me just throw in here right now that the Bahamas Crisis Center also has a 24-hour hotline, and the number for that is 328-0922.
Yes, and we work very closely with the Bahamas Crisis Center.
That is awesome. That is awesome. An organization like that, you know, it's small, but it, like my our Jamaican friend said, Talawa. Small, but Italawa. All right, so tell us briefly, what is domestic violence?
So domestic violence is any form of violence or discord that happens in a domestic situation where You're living in the same residence. You have a personal relationship. And that could be a romantic relationship, but it could also be a familial relationship where you have family members who have discord, who are either fighting physically or there's verbal fighting. There could also be psychological abuse. There can also be emotional abuse and even financial abuse, where one person is taking power over another person, and it's really about power and control.
Absolutely. So in that sense, in the household, typically everybody is at the same level in the hierarchy of power except for children, right? Like all the adults are the same except for children. How do we talk about young people in the household and domestic violence? Do we consider abuse against young adults and young people older than children domestic violence?
Well, it depends. So if it's an adult who's perpetrating the violence on a child who is under the age of 18, that's child abuse.
Okay.
Regardless if they're not a small child, if they're a teenager or an adolescent, that's child abuse. So that's different than domestic violence. But we also see where teenagers who are in relationship with each other, there can be violence in those relationships. And actually, the Crisis Center has a campaign called Healthy Relationships, where they go into the high schools and they teach teenagers what it is to be in a healthy relationship so they can recognize when they're not in one.
Absolutely. So in your intro, it says that you've worked with vulnerable populations for nearly 20 years. What is a vulnerable population, like in the sense of this work?
So it's a population that really is impacted in terms of their power to move themselves out of their situation. So they don't have the financial resources, or they're not, for children, they're dependent on someone else to take care of their needs. And in the case of a domestic violence situation, most times that victim is dependent on the other person for their needs, either financial or housing needs, or a lot of cases we see with foreign wives who are married to Bahamian men, or even foreign men who are married to Bahamian women, who the spouse uses their immigration status as a form of control. So it's any population that doesn't that is dependent upon another for their needs to be met, and they don't have the full resources available to them to meet their day-to-day needs.
Wow. And so in the Bahamas, like in our sort of local context, which categories of people do we find are the most vulnerable to domestic violence?
Women are most vulnerable. They are disproportionately impacted by domestic violence. So that is the greatest population that is impacted. And then when you think about violence as a whole, you have children who are also very vulnerable to violence. And then you have your elderly people. We don't talk about that enough, that the elderly population is also very vulnerable to violence and abuse.
Absolutely. And so I want to ask you about I want to ask you 1,000 questions, but I also want to give you the space to share what you think is important for us to know, to be aware of, and to talk about. But also, you shared with me a brief page of statistics from the period January to September 2021 on domestic-related crimes. So I want to ask you to start by telling us, what exactly is a domestic-related crime? See, because I never thought I'd say this out loud, but I think my mother is thief my mangoes. And I think that's a domestic-related crime. And I want to call somebody.
Well, yeah, so a domestic-related crime is a crime that would happen between two people who are in some sort of relationship. And it could also be something where they had to come to a home and deal with a situation. So it has to do with to the individuals being in some sort of intimate relationship, and that doesn't have to mean sexual. It could just mean between family members. That's an intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. So that's what domestic means.
Okay, and so the crime doesn't have to necessarily take place in the home or domicile.
Right.
It could be between two people that are either in an intimate relationship, romantic, or live in a domicile together.
Right.
Okay, all right. And so what are some of, well, I'm looking at the stats, and when I looked at the sheet, I was surprised. So some of the crimes listed here are murder, attempted murder, assault with a deadly weapon, and there's a long list of crimes. And then we look at domestic reports, and it says general. What does that sort of mean, domestic reports?
I don't know. And I had, when I got that information, we were reaching out to, because we had gotten it from a source at the police, from the Royal Bahamas Police. And so we were waiting back to get some clarification on that general. I guess if it doesn't fit in any of those other categories, mm-hmm. then they would put it there.
I got you. Yeah. So now the sheet that you sent me is also has a comparison of the crimes that were reported in 2021 versus 2020. And both of these years are what we're going to call pandemic years, right?
Right.
We are in the pandemic. How have you seen a trend up or a trend down in domestic violence since the onset of the pandemic?
We definitely, from the beginning of this year, saw a trend upwards in terms of the number of people who were coming to us seeking help for domestic violence-related issues. And globally, that has been a trend. So that is not just unique to us. And when you do the reading and the research on the why of that, it's because people were quarantined and locked down in places where they might not necessarily have been safe to do so, right? So if normally my perpetrator is out to work for most of the day, we're not in close relation to each other for there to be friction all the time. But then when everybody wasn't working, we're all home, and everyone in the frustration level is escalated, and you know, money woes are coming up and people are increasingly stressed, we saw incidents of domestic violence definitely increase.
Wow. One of the interesting stats here is assistance requested is a category, and in 2020, there were 411 requests for assistance. And in 2021, there were only 184 requests for assistance.
Right.
You think this is because in 2021, we had no lockdowns, curfews had been extended, and people had more space to sort of escape outside of the home?
I think that is a definite contribution to that. I think when people have things to do, when they have somewhere to go, you sort of get that break from being in close quarters with people that you don't necessarily get along with. And some people were forced into living with relatives or even I've had cases where, you know, young ladies are saying, well, I had to go live with my ex because I had nowhere to go, and we have these kids, and mm-hmm. we don't get along, but, you know, for the sake of the kids, we were trying to live together. We've been fighting for a year, and I got to get out of there.
Yeah.
So people were forced to make choices that they didn't necessarily want to, but were forced into because they just didn't have the resources to make it on their own.
Absolutely. So from looking at these stats and the premise of our conversation, it suggests to me that the state and the Ministry of Social Services and perhaps in partnership with civil society and NGOs, that we need to be prioritizing the creation and operation of shelters and temporary housing options for people in crisis and in transition, whether from a say, domestic situation or simply transition from the family island to New Providence?
And Aaron, you just hit the nail on the head of the bane of my very existence in this work. It's housing is a challenge. And, you know, I've had to support women and, you know, unfortunately, I haven't dealt with any men, but I know that this does impact men as well. But I've had to work with people who have to go back home because there's nowhere else for them to go. We don't have long-term shelters for people. We don't have a method for them to go. We are very limited in those resources.
Absolutely.
And social services is limited in what we can provide. We don't just service domestic violence survivors. We service everybody who
Absolutely.
Needs the housing.
Ms. Millis,
you know, so
we got to take a break. When we come back from the break, we're going to focus on that housing, and then we're going to talk about some of the barriers that people experience in reporting and attempting to report these crimes.
Okay.
We got to go to a break. Please stay tuned. 96.9 FM, a really decent conversation on domestic violence in the Bahamas. We'll be right back.
What happened to you?
You look like you lost your paycheck.
Man, I just realized I got scammed out of a bunch of money. They said I won this contest and just needed me to send them some money so I could collect. I mean, to expedite something. Or was it to smooth the process?
Man, you're smarter than that. Protect yourself against scams and fraud by following these tips. If you know you didn't enter a competition, you can't win. Never pay to receive a cash prize. If you're being asked, you're being scammed. Check trusted internet sites for verification of information given to you. Do not give your banking details to people you don't know. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. Monitor your bank account regularly for any questionable transactions.
Get more information at GetMoneySmartBahamas.com.
Invite students in grades 4 through 12 to compete in the Get Money Smart Bahamas video essay competition. Students must produce a 3 to 5 minute essay sharing their views on the following topic. The Bahamian economy is an ideal model for digital financial services. Get a parent or guardian permission to share the link to your essay with us on social media and have your entry judged for cash prizes in either the primary school division, junior high, or senior high school category. Essay submissions must be received by October 22nd, 2021. For more information, visit GetMoneySmartBahamas.com or see our post on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Good morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. You are on the clock with Erin Green, and I am speaking to Ms. Tonette Minnis. She is a trained social worker currently working in the Domestic Violence and Counseling Unit at the Department of Social Services, and she's an adjunct professor at the University of the Bahamas. Now, Ms. Minnis, you have now been officially declared a national resource, and I'm going to encourage you to encourage other people to reach out to you because you seem to be, you are very knowledgeable. So let's talk about some of the barriers. Why are some of the reasons that people are not reporting domestic violence and domestic-related crimes?
Well, I think there's some systemic issues with the reporting process and some of the elements connected to it. One of the greatest things that, or the biggest complaints that I have gotten is one of the practices, I don't know if this is standard, but having to sit in a room and confront your accuser while you both are questioned, or confront the perpetrator while you both are questioned, which... it's something that's done as a practice of the police in some way, shape, or form. And I think that while, you know, we understand that may be a practice, it's something that we need to look into the impact on the psychological impact on the victim, having to go through that. And a lot of people decide not to move forward because they don't want to go through that process.
Absolutely.
There's also a whole nother can of worms, and we probably talk about this another time, in terms of same-sex couples who try to report domestic violence and they're not taken seriously.
Okay.
So that's another barrier as well.
All right. Now, Ms. Minnis, as you've noted, we are completely out of time.
Yes, indeed.
I will have you back on, and let's plan for next week before International Domestic Violence Awareness Month has passed.
Yes,
and I'm sure, and then we'll have some space to open up the line for questions. Please give the audience your contact information or the information, contact information for the unit in the Ministry of Social, Department of Social Services.
Yes, so if you require additional information or you know someone or are someone who is in need of assistance in a domestic violence situation, you can give us a call at 604-4300. And we are located in the Sunshine Plaza on Blue Hill Road, upstairs in Building B in the Sunshine Complex, which is the same complex as the main social services headquarters.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Ms. Minnis. I'm all out of time. I got to go. And I want you to hang up the phone because I don't want you to be on the phone line when I tell the police that this sounds ridiculous. Certainly, you could not be forcing victims of crimes to sit across from their accuser. And I've been told that there's the suggestion that the accused has the right to face their accuser. But that happens in court. That happens before a judge. I tell you, hang up the phone for me, Ms. Minnis. That happens before a judge. That doesn't happen in an interrogation room. That is a vile and heinous process, particularly knowing that you use it for victims of rape and sexual abuse as well. It is certainly something that doesn't warrant. It requires interrogation. See what I did? That requires interrogation, not the victim of crimes by the accused. Anyway, I gotta go. I'd like to thank you for your patience. It's 11 o'clock. That means Levon Miller and Unleashed is up next. So thank you for staying tuned to On the Clock despite our technical difficulties. And I will attempt to bring Ms. Minnis back on next week so we could investigate and interrogate this scourge in our country called domestic violence. Have a great day, Bahamas.